Okay, Mr. Price, when you're ready.
May it please the court, Your Honor, my name is Philip Price, and I represent the plaintiffs in the Rowland case, and we represent the retirees who rolled over their retirement funds to Stanford and invested all of their life savings in the CDs. Now, SEI, who is the primary defendant in this case, is one of the most successful and sophisticated truck operation companies in the world. Alan Stanford and SEI set up a trust company 10 years ago to serve one function, to serve as custodian for IRA accounts that only purchased SIB CDs. And the reason why that distinction is important, the Stanford Trust Company IRA accounts did not purchase covered securities. Unlike where the court has considered this in Enron, WorldCom, and Miller, this case does not involve an issuer of covered securities. So the primary question that needs to be addressed by this court is what authority exists to ignore the character of the initial purchase of non-covered securities. I respectfully submit that there's no congressional history, there's no case law, and there's no statute for any court to ignore the character of the original security that was purchased.
What about the Madoff cases in the Southern District of New York? I know they're split, but several cases that say that purchase of those feeder funds was in connection with a covered security.
The circuit still hasn't that.
The circuit has not decided. The Second Circuit has not made the decision.
When was that case, Arnold?
And those cases out of the district court basically are not debt security cases. And a lot of those cases turn on the attribution of the covered securities to a person that invested at the top fund. And the big difference in this case is that we have a debt security of which they're being paid interest, but the direct, indirect ownership of the covered securities is not attributable to the investors. And we submit to the court that that is a big distinction. The second distinction deals...
So are you saying that the Madoff cases or the decision by the Second Circuit wouldn't have any bearing on this? Can this?
No, I think
the Stanford case can be distinguished from the Madoff cases and would not.
No, I think that the Anwar case and the pension committee case, which goes in the same direction, which goes in our favor, are an important consideration. I mean, one of the cases in the pension committee case is the heart of the fraud. In other words, what is the heart of the fraud in this case? And I submit to this court that at the time that the people that we represent invested in the stock or the SIB CD, the company was hopelessly insolvent. This court has ruled that the Ponzi scheme commenced in 1998 and that it was insolvent from inception. So what happens is at the time the people that we represent invested, it was hopelessly insolvent. So it makes no difference. It makes no difference whether they invested in covered securities or not, because it was hopelessly insolvent at the time that our people invested. The other issue that comes out of the district.
Is it your position that the test ought to require for the statute to apply? It ought to apply necessarily if there's some misrepresentation with reference to covered securities?
It's not that broad, Your Honor. What it looks at is that you have an initial transaction. SLUSA was passed to deal with a number of situations to stop abusive, vexatious lawsuits. And it stopped dead in its track issuer type of lawsuits. Like, in other words, if you have a company that issues an IPO and the value goes down, there's no question that those cases are precluded by SLUSA. If you have a company that's registered on the New York Stock Exchange, there's no question the value goes down and somebody files a lawsuit. There's no question that's covered. And this is an issue or lawsuit under what we call the 33 Act exemption. And what happened was is that there is a security issued that is not a covered security. And the effect of that is there's no law other than the two cases out of the Southern District.
Does it matter that there was representations that the CDs were invested in securities?
It does to the extent that the allegations would be against the investment advisors. But as the court probably is aware, we have argued that with SEI, we have made no allegations about them in connection with the covered securities. And that leads to the whole Abbott line of cases of which the defendants, the different claims against each of the defendants should be considered separately. And as it relates to SEI, there is no involvement of SEI with any covered security. They did not perform the reporting work for Stanford International Bank. They performed it for the trust company, and they only perform the valuation on the SIBCD. And as I said in the beginning, the only thing that they did was they were set up solely to capture my client's funds and to invest them in the SIBCDs. They had no relationship with the covered securities.
Did the CDs have a fixed rate of return, or did the they had interest depend on how well the money did that was invested, or was there a fixed rate of return,
and they were based upon the solvency of the company. And it goes back to the point that I was making before. At the time that our clients invested in it, the company was hopelessly insolvent. This court has ruled that. So where their money went is irrelevant to the misrepresentation aspect of the case because of the fact that the company was insolvent. And that's what people that invest in debt look at. They look at the net worth of the company. And as we set forth in our brief, this court has considered on three different occasions the Ponzi scheme that was affected. And the Ponzi scheme involves going out and Alan Stanford taking the money, taking it in personal loans, and that is really what the misrepresentation is about. The heart of the matter, the heart of the fraud, is the pension committee case in the district court is really the key issue. What is the heart of the fraud here in this case, particularly as it relates to SEI? There's no question. But I would say this, there's been a lot of discussion about whether this law should be interpreted in a non-technical manner and whether it should be interpreted in a flexible manner. And that language arises out of the Zanford case. And I think the most important thing that the court needs to take from the Zanford case is that it says Congress has sought to substitute a philosophy of full disclosure for a philosophy of caveat emptor. In other words, what Zanford says, we will interpret the law to support a policy of full disclosure and not caveat emptor. Any interpretation of the law that condones a don't ask, don't tell relationship, similar to what we've alleged against SEI and Alan Stanford, is supporting a culture of caveat emptor. In this day and time, with the problems we have in the security market, we present to this court that you should not adopt a policy which allows an institution like SEI to say, don't ask, don't tell. And as we've alleged in our lawsuit, that is exactly what happened. They were there at the birth of the Stanford Trust. They were there at the death of the Stanford Trust. Their sole job was to report on the value of the SIBCDs. It's not like you see in a lot of cases where it's just one time. They were there from inception. And I think that's an important point. And I think the other thing that we talk about in Dabbitt says you interpret it liberally if it's a vexatious strike lawsuit. I don't think that anybody in this room will stand up and say to you today that this is a vexatious strike lawsuit. $7 billion has disappeared. It's disappeared because of the lack of the requirement with law with various institutions, in our opinion, that have supported and added legitimacy to Allen Stanford.
Let me just ask you, your point about SEI is that they didn't make any direct representations to the plaintiffs?
That they did not make any direct representations to the plaintiff. What they did do is they were reporting on a monthly basis the value of the SIBCDs.
Right. Falsely reporting, according to you?
Well, we believe that what they should have done is had some inquiries that would support the value of the CDs. In other words, they reported the CDs on a monthly basis.
Well, let me ask you, does it really matter whether they made direct misrepresentations to the plaintiffs? Isn't it enough if they furthered the fraud that was being committed?
Well, we believe that they were the primary contact with the investors on an ongoing basis because of the reporting mechanism. They were only reporting on the SIBCDs, and that was how the investors determined what the value was.
It doesn't mean just the happening, the court said, that involved covered securities. It's something than that. But if we should decide in our case that it does require something on the part of the seller, not the subjective thinking the buyer is going to have to sell some covered securities in order to invest in the CD. Then how does the court unravel all of this to decide what it was that in fact happened in this trade? How was this marketed for some the plaintiffs and not for others? There's so many plaintiffs and so many defendants in this case. I don't. For example, 12B6, that may be clearly wrong, 12B6. But we need some sort of rule, and we need to think about the consequence of how the courts are going to eventually decide to apply it to the particular argument that might develop between the parties.
Yes, can I respond?
Yes.
We need what I call a yellow line of demarcation. It's exactly what you just said, because if we go out and do a broad interpretation, then the next issue this court is going to be facing in another case where the investor defendants are sued, they're going to say that this SLUSA supersedes Tufta. That's exactly what's getting ready to happen if you take this broad interpretation of the law. So you have to look for a yellow line of demarcation. And the yellow line of demarcation in this case is what was the original purchase? Was the original purchase a covered security or not a covered security? There is no law in the United States that suggests that you look at the assets of an issuer to determine whether or not a debt security is a covered security. And Judge Prado, I misstated that a while ago in terms of but the two cases out of the district court in New York are the ones that support our position. Prior to the time that those Madoff cases came up, which are obviously a different situation, no cases focused on any security other than what was purchased. So if the court is looking to draw a yellow line of demarcation where SLUSA is not extended as a preclusion to every, and I'm literally talking about every claim against a registered company. That's really what we're talking about here. To stop that, then you need to focus on the original transaction. And just for the record, SEI never raised this issue for 2 years. I mean, I think everybody pretty well realized what the law was on the point.
Well,
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Mr. Jones?
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Young, and I represent the plaintiffs in the Willis and Proskauer cases. In my brief time this morning, I'd like to address three issues: the absence of any downstream purchase or sale of covered securities, the trial court's upstream theory, and the trial court's speculation regarding the existence of covered securities. The trial court dismissed this case under SLUSA even though no one bought or sold covered securities, and no one contracted to buy or sell covered securities. Those facts make this case unique among cases in which SLUSA preclusion has been found. What the plaintiffs bought were not covered securities. They were certificates of deposit in a bank. And what SIB bought was, in very large part, not covered securities. Indeed, it was mostly speculative Antiguan real estate. And to the minor extent that it may have actually bought covered securities, that is not the subject of any fraud allegations on the plaintiff's part. Now, the defendant's point...
But at some point, tell me, it wouldn't make a difference that they told the buyers. Their brochure was more specific than it was in this case, and it said, we are backing up our operations with an elaborate portfolio of New York Stock Exchange 500 companies.
Let me answer that in two ways. First of all, that is not exactly what they told them. They told them that they were investing in safe, secure, and liquid assets, including...
I know that in this case.
Right.
But I was thinking,
okay,
what if it was expressed and stated, we are substantial and we have assets to back up?
It still would not make a difference, Your Honor, and here's why. The reason that the non-sale or non-purchase of a covered security is treated as the sale or purchase is because of the language of Section 10B. And the 1933 and 34 Acts specify that a purchase includes a contract to purchase and a sale includes a contract to sell. So if I, as a broker, take your money to buy stock and I abscond with the money instead of buying the stock, I have contracted with you to sell you stock, and that is deemed a sale under the statute. Here there was no one that either sold or contracted to sell or purchased or contracted to purchase. These CDs were debt instruments. The purchaser acquired only an in personam obligation on the part of the bank to redeem the CD at maturity. It did not acquire a security interest in the asset. It did not require, Judge Prado, an income interest. The interest was not tied in any way to the performance of the investments. In fact, it did not acquire any other interest in SIB's asset. And so we believe the Madoff cases, however they may come out in the Second Circuit, are distinguishable on this point. In each of those cases, either the plaintiff was directly buying covered securities through Madoff or was indirectly buying an equity interest in covered securities by investing in a feeder fund that was set up to in turn purchase into the Madoff program. Well, the statute, Your Honor, requires not only a misrepresentation about securities, it requires a misrepresentation in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. And so, for example, if I am considering going into business with someone and I say, prove to me that you're a substantial person that I can count on, that has the financial backing that I need, and I look at his balance sheet, it does not become securities fraud merely because there are some securities on that balance sheet. Why not? Because there's no purchase or sale or contract to purchase or sell covered securities.
Well, same is true in Madoff cases, though, isn't it?
It is not, Your Honor, because Madoff was claiming to invest in covered securities. So those who dealt directly with Madoff were contracting with Madoff to purchase covered securities. Those who dealt with Madoff through a feeder fund were indirectly purchasing feeder fund interests with the intent and understanding of all parties that those would be invested in Madoff funds.
If you want to make the test, what was the product being marketed or what was he buying? The Madoff buyers were buying shares in the feeder fund.
Well, if you treat the feeder fund as a wholly distinct entity from the Madoff fraud, that would be correct. And some of the cases that go our way on that point do that. The cases that go the opposite way make a point of saying these feeder funds were not independent investments. They were understood by all parties to be a mechanism for investing in Madoff. So if you're prepared to pierce that corporate veil a little bit, then you get the result of SLUSA preemption. If you're not, then you don't.
Don't you think that the selling point of these CDs, where they said that the money will be invested in securities, if you purchase these CDs, the money's going to be somehow involved in invested in securities, would be enough of a connection to meet the standard?
I do not, Your Honor. First of all, that's not exactly what was said. There were no promises that specific monies were going to be invested in a specific way. Instead, the representations were, let me tell you about SIB. Let me tell you about why SIB is so solid. We invest only in this, that, and the other thing. There was never a representation, Mr. Investor, we're going to take your money and invest it in X, Y, and Z. And that would not be enough, even if there had been, because there was no contract to invest for the investor's benefit in a covered security. The losses on that covered security, the gains on that covered security, the income on that covered security would redound to the bank, not to the investor. And debt is simply different. We know that from the Supreme Court's O'Hagan case. Money breaks the chain between securities and fraud because it can be used for many things other than securities. When the defendant steals money and then buys securities, the theft is not in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. It follows that when the defendant steals money and then doesn't buy securities, the non-purchase is again not in connection with the purchase and sale of securities.
So you would draw a line between misrepresentation about what I have to back up my operation and a misrepresentation about what I'm going to do with this money. If you misrepresent my business with my connection with my hedge fund problems and contacts and all, I'm going to make it possible for you to get this higher rate of interest by using this money that you're buying my CDs with and put it in these people that know how better to deal with covered securities.
I don't believe it necessarily would, where what I'm purchasing is a debt instrument. If what I am purchasing is an equity instrument, then I think it would. But when what I am purchasing is a debt instrument, a statement about what will be done with the money is nothing more than a statement about how the bank intends to conduct the bank's own affairs. It has nothing to do with a contract with the investor for the purchase of covered securities.
Well, it's certainly designed to get the money coming in. I mean, that's what the fraud is designed for.
Well, it was designed to reassure the investors as to how it was that SIB could give these above-market returns. That is correct. I want to briefly discuss what we call the upstream theory, that is that the sale of covered securities by investors in order to purchase these CDs somehow implicates SLUSA. The fraud in this case was directed against the plaintiff's money, not against the plaintiff's securities, and that is a critical distinction. In the Supreme Court's Bankers Life case, the fraud was directed against bonds held by a life insurance company. In the Zanford case, the fraud was directed against securities in the plaintiff's brokerage account and the proceeds from those securities. Where the target is not securities, it makes no sense to categorize fraud as securities fraud just because the funds happen to come from securities.
If we were to accept that, then would you have to go look at each individual investor and see who sold securities to get involved and who didn't?
You absolutely would, Your Honor, under the upstream theory. And in the Willis case, we allege that none of the named plaintiffs did sell covered securities. These were Mexican and Venezuelan plaintiffs who would not necessarily, in the ordinary course, have their money invested in U.S.-traded stocks. They might, but they might not. You'd have tracing issues. What if I sell a covered security, put the money in a bank account, and 10 years later buy something?
What if one or a certain percentage of the investors had sold securities to purchase these CDs? Would that cover those that had not?
We don't.
And would they be part of the class or could not?
You would have to deal with those issues, and remember, SLUSA deals with allegations, not with how the facts ultimately turn out. An action alleging misrepresentations in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. You would sweep in to securities fraud a lot of garden variety fraud. If I sell some stock and buy a used car and the used car salesman defrauds me, that would become 10b-5 securities fraud. And we have no reason to believe that Congress intended that.
All right.
My
thank
time
you.
Has expired.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Ruhanda.
May it please the Court, James Ruhanda from Davis Polk and Wardwell Counsel for Proskauer, arguing on behalf of all defendants in the Choice v. Proskauer action. This case involves a straightforward application of SLUSA. The complaint alleges that Stanford targeted brokerage customers who had pre-existing securities accounts and pushed them to divest those holdings and invest in CDs. The complaint further alleges that the proceeds from those CD sales would be used to buy covered securities, what they are described in the complaint as highly liquid, marketable, and also described as stocks and bonds issued by multinational corporations.
Thus, in some of these cases,
it is the allegation in the Choice action. I'll let my others speak to the other complaints. But in the 11031 case, yes, it is clear on the face of the complaint, and this is how Judge Godbee read it, that they were targeting brokerage. In fact, they incentivized brokers who had clients with brokerage accounts to come to them. Divest those holdings and push those investors into the CDs, and then also that those CD proceeds would be invested in marketable securities. And so,
what did it say? Not covered securities.
No, it said it variously described it as highly liquid, marketable, and as stocks and bonds. Which I think, if you put those together, and other courts have said, a mere allegation of stocks and bonds is enough to make it a covered securities, but certainly when you say they're highly liquid and marketable and issued by international corporations, it's not a leap at all to say those are covered securities. So the in connection with requirement of SLUSA is satisfied when a broker fraudulently induces someone to sell a customer to sell securities, and it's also satisfied where someone fraudulently induces a customer to hand over money to be invested in securities that, when in fact the allegation is there was never any intent to invest in those securities.
Now,
that's Dabbitt and Zanford.
Here they were buying CDs. Do we just stop there and say they were buying CDs? You're going an extra step and say, but the money in the CDs was maybe going to be invested in securities. Are we going that far, or do we just stop and say this only deals with CDs and securities? The statute doesn't go that extra step beyond just these people were investing in CDs. How do we know that these people were depending on the representation that this money was going into securities? Does that matter that people were buying only CDs and they had a fixed rate of return? End of story.
It's not an extra step, we would argue, and that's the teaching of Dabbitt and Zanford, because under Dabbitt and Zanford, the question is, what is the fraudulent scheme that's alleged? So it's the fraudulent scheme that has to coincide with the purchase of sale of securities. It's not whether or not, it was a CD that was invested in that was to be backed by marketable securities. There are marketable securities that are alleged to be part of the fraudulent scheme. I will invest in marketable securities. Absent that, and remember, SLUSA is to be read the same way as 10B. The in connection with requirement is the same in 10B and in SLUSA. The SEC would not be able to go after brokers who fraudulently induce clients to hand over money with the promise that they're going to invest in covered securities. And Zanford said, looking at the SEC's interpretation, which it said it was entitled to deference because it was reasonable in the Bauer case, that does apply. If you fraudulently induce someone to invest, hand over the money with the promise that you're going to invest in securities.
But the product being marketed is a covered security, and that's not true in this case.
That's true. The product being marketed is the CD, but what's important is what is the scheme that's alleged. There are purchases and sales of securities, a promise to purchase of sales of securities on one end, and on the front end, the allegation is going after brokerage customers who have securities in their accounts to sell them. So,
but if your test is going to be if covered securities are anywhere in the scheme, you can go a long way there.
Well, the test is, I believe, under Zanford, whether or not, I think it says it directly, that whether the fraudulent scheme is enough that the scheme to defraud and the sale of securities coincide. And in fact, the Fourth Circuit and the Second Circuit, those were both in Zanford and Dabbitt, those were both reversals where what the Fourth Circuit and the Second Circuit were doing were trying to come up with a narrower reading of SLUSA. The Fourth Circuit said that in Zanford, that the sale of securities from the account of the alleged victim was incidental to the fraud that occurred when the perpetrator absconded with the money. And the Supreme Court said no. Selling a customer securities with an intent to misappropriate the proceeds, that the in connection with requirement is in fact met.
Some of the cases talk about the fraud being the fraud in connection with covered securities being at the heart of the case. And the farther you get away from the misrepresentation that directly relates to the covered security, the further you get away from it being at the heart of the case.
It is at the heart of the case here. It is the misrepresentation that, for example, on the end of we will invest the CD proceeds in covered securities, in highly liquid marketable securities, that was the heart of the fraud. That was the misrepresentation. That's what the plaintiffs say caused their damages. The failure to do that, the failure to put the money into the CD proceeds into IBM and other highly liquid marketable stocks that could have been just wound down, that was what caused their damages. That, in essence, was the heart of the fraudulent scheme. It's both the misrepresentation and the causation.
Would you happen to have any insight into where the Madoff-Peter case before the Second Circuit stands, being closer to the area than we are? Do you have any insight as to where that court stands on up with a ruling?
I don't off the top of my head. Perhaps some of my colleagues do, but I will say that I think the answer to the Madoff-Peter funds case is in Judge Godbee's decision, wherein he looks at them and says, well, there's really this one outlier case, the Anwar case. And certainly I think that the Madoff-Peter funds, I believe the Second Circuit, will go with a majority view there. Because as in Dabbitt, that was where they tried to have a little bit more restrictive ruling. And that's a very interesting case, because there they said, the Second Circuit said in Dabbitt, well, if the plaintiff didn't purchase, and this goes to the product marketer, they said if the plaintiff did not purchase or sell the securities, instead was just a holder of securities, or maybe delayed selling the securities, in connection with requirement was not met. Again, the Supreme Court reversed and said that's not correct. The sale doesn't have to be, the purchase or sale doesn't have to be by the defrauded party, the plaintiff. It does not have to be by that party.
Would you agree that the Madoff cases where the money was going into the feeder fund that in turn was going to go into equities is more direct directly related to covered securities than your case.
No, I think the our case, it's the heart. It is absolutely directly related because that's what they were, what the investors were promised and was misrepresented to them was that we're going to be able to pay these a good rate of return on the CDs because we have people who are going to invest in these highly marketable liquid securities. It's a common misrepresentation, and without it, the SEC would be unable to go after, in that case, would be able, unable to go after parties in that case,
well,
in that situation.
Because I did not understand from Judge Godbee's opinion and the briefs that the allegation was this specific as to what was to be done with the proceeds of the sale of the CDs.
It is specific. It's in the record at 179 and 80 that they were to be invested in a diversified, highly liquid portfolio of marketable securities. If you put the allegations together, they also allege that it'll be included in stocks and bonds. And I believe it was the La Scala case in the Central District of California said that's enough to establish covered securities. But one additional point, which is there's a suggestion that affirmance here would leave the plaintiffs without any remedy. And I think it's important to point out that there is still a potential remedy here because what SELUSA said, it doesn't actually preempt the claim. It simply says you cannot use the class action device to bring the claim. Correct. And this isn't the case where you have very small investors, as they've alleged. There are very significant investors. And I do believe that also in terms of the there's no doubt that there were purchases and sales of securities. That's clear from the Yoder Declaration, which the court took judicial notice of. So in this case, there were actual purchases and sales of securities.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Polk.
I gather that it's a whole new line of lawyers that are in Houston, separate and apart from the lawyers that are here today. They're handling the other part of the case that's going on in Houston. I hear there's something going on in Houston involving something.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
None of y'all are involved in that. I gather you're here with us today.
All right. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jonathan Polks, and I'm here from Weil Gotshal representing Willis and arguing on behalf of all the defendants in the Willis track, all the appellees. I'd like, if I may, to start with to follow up on a question that Judge Prado asked, and it's also a question that you were just getting at, I think, as well, Your Honor, Judge Reveley. The appellants are basically pitching this as a case where the CD is what was being sold and the analysis should stop there. And you hear the appellees saying, no, 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 there are these additional allegations about the CDs are being backed by covered securities. I submit that what's important is not what the parties say about it, but what the complaint says. And I think on that score, Judge Godbee went through it in great detail, but I mean, I can point the court to a couple of paragraphs where it's just unmistakable that the nature of the fraud that's alleged is not just buy my CDs. The nature of the fraud alleged is buy my CDs because they pay a higher rate of return because they're covered by very safe liquid securities. That was the pitch. That's what was being marketed. Paragraph 121 of the complaint in the Willis action, just by way of example, says that Stanford Financial trained its advisors to stress liquidity in their marketing pitches to prospective customers, telling the brokers and advisors that, quote, this is quote in the complaint, liquidity marketability of SIB invested assets was the most important factor to provide security to SIB clients. That's their words. That's not my words. And in fact, to make this really, really underscore this point, in paragraph 180 of the complaint, the appellants themselves allege that these allegations about the CDs being backed by covered securities were material to the fraudulent scheme. That's what they say. Now, there's lots of law. The Fifth Circuit has said it in the Miller case. There's lots of law that when dealing with SLUSA issues, it's just too easy for plaintiffs to try and leave out key words like don't say anything about a covered security, don't say anything about a misrepresentation, charge it as a breach of contract, and so forth. It's too easy to do that. And so all the cases say in every circuit, including the Fifth, that you have to look to the reality that underlies the pleadings. what's the actual fraud that's alleged? And I submit that, as Judge Godbee found, and even if all you had were the few snippets that I just read to you, it is simply not true to say that the only thing here alleges that they were selling CDs, and that it is unmistakably true that the scheme, the fraudulent scheme, was pitched that these CDs were extra safe and pay a high rate of return because of how the funds were being invested. And as in the appellant's own words, those allegations were material to the scheme. Once you get there, I respectfully submit the rest of the analysis becomes very easy. In fact, there's nothing about this. This case could be affirmed, I respectfully submit, with a very conservatively written opinion. There may be a day when this court has to decide a tough application of SLUSA, but this isn't that case, because everything that needs to be done here is based on very well-respected authority. For example, the appellants say that, well, the purchases or sales of securities here were by the tortfeasor, you know, by the alleged bad guy, so that doesn't count. Well, the O'Hagan case by the Supreme Court, the Zanford case by the Supreme Court, and a host of Court of Appeals cases, Siegel in the Sixth Circuit, Siebel in the Eighth Circuit, Romano in the Second Circuit, that's exactly what happened in every one of those cases. The purchase or sale of the security was by the defendant in those cases. So there's nothing remarkable about that. They also say, well, there really were no purchases or sales of securities here. That was just part of the fraud. There's nothing new about that either. In the Zanford case by the Supreme Court specifically said that it's a violation of 10b-5, relying on the same in connection with language, Your Honor, and 10b-5 is the same language in SLUSA, for a broker to claim he's going to use your money to buy securities, but instead to steal that money and embezzle it. In that scenario, there never was a purchase or sale of a security. It was part of the fraudulent scheme, right? So that's easy. There's nothing remarkable, and plus you have all the Madoff cases, right? But I submit you don't even need to get to those. This is all very sort of easy, well-established stuff. And I think now to turn to the legal aspect of it, again, once we've established and once the court is satisfied that the nature of the fraudulent scheme here is the pitch, the fraudulent pitch here is buy my CDs, we'll pay you more because they're invested safely, okay, in covered securities. Once you get there, the question of whether or not the fraud here was in connection with the purchase or sale of securities, whether the purchase or sale of securities coincides with the fraudulent scheme, that's the phrase that comes out of the Supreme Court data case. Well, of course it does.
So if you have covered securities anywhere in the fraudulent scheme, that's all you need to show.
Well, Your Honor, the language that the Supreme Court uses is it's got the purchase or sale has to coincide with.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, I think what it means is it's got to be part of the fraud. And I know that there's lots of locutions for it. But Judge Godbee in this case, Your Honor, used actually one of the toughest standards. I know there's different circuits have applied that coincides with the fraud language. And it is a funny use of words. Many different times, there are tests that have come up. The Sixth Circuit in Siegel said it's a modest test. It's just got to be part of the scheme. Other courts have come up with the inducement test. Judge Godbee here actually used the inducement test. That's a tough one. That says that the purchase or sale of the covered securities has to actually have induced the person to enter into the fraud. But I would submit, Your Honor, and this is sort of what I was saying by this isn't a tough case, the facts here satisfy almost any test you can imagine, even the tougher inducement test, because of what I just said about the nature of the pitch. I mean, if I could take a step back.
Did Judge Godbee's test, was that the proper test, inducement? It came out okay for you, but would you say that's the proper test to apply?
That actually goes to my point. I don't think it matters, and I think that if this court chose to affirm, it could even, if it wished to, be so conservative as to say we don't take a position on what the proper test is now, but under any conceivable test, this would have satisfied it.
Well, it wouldn't satisfy the test what product was being marketed.
I think it would. Because the product that was being marketed here was a CD backed by covered securities.
Well, the product was a CD. The buyer wanted a fixed rate of return on a CD.
But Your Honor, the allegation here is that it was material to what Stanford was selling people, that this was not just a CD. CDs paid much lower rates of return. What was being promised here was a CD that paid a higher rate of return because the funds were being invested in covered securities. That's what was being told. And in fact, Your Honor, if we could just take a step back for a second, remember, this is a Ponzi scheme. So by definition, Stanford can't be telling its victims the truth about what it's doing with the money, or we wouldn't be here today, right? Stanford can't say, I'm going to sell you a CD, I'm going to take your money from that, and I'm going to steal it, and I'm going to buy airlines and hotels and pay off other investors. There would be no scheme. So what the investors are being told about the proceeds of the CD sales is the scheme. There wouldn't be one without it. So the lie is not just buy my CD. The lie is buy my CD. My CD is better than others because it is backed by safe, liquid government bonds, high-quality stocks. It's safe. You should buy it. In that respect, it is exactly like the Madoff line of cases. Because in the Madoff cases, if you remember the scheme, sort of the big picture again, Madoff promised higher rates of return and more consistent rates of return because he said he had, falsely, some brilliant strategy to invest in options. This is no different. Here what people are being told is buy our CDs, don't buy those other guys' CDs, because other banks make commercial loans. We don't. We take your money, we put it in high quality, covered securities, that way it's safer and we can pay you more. That is the fraud. There's no fraud without that statement.
You don't see a difference between this case and the Madoff cases?
I actually think I don't think there's any significant distinction between them for the reason that I just gave. Just as in Madoff, and I don't think that's essential for us to win, by the way, but I don't think there's an important difference. In Madoff, if the court reads the cases or even remembers from the newspapers, what people were being told is Madoff would say, if you give me your money, I'm going to invest it in covered government bond options, which is going to ensure you a higher rate of return. In that respect, the case is exactly like this one. And again, not according to me, it doesn't matter what the appellants say today, what their pleadings were, what matters is what they pled. And they pled that it was material to the fraud, their words, not mine, material to the fraud, that people were being told that the CD proceeds would be invested safely and that therefore they would get a higher rate of return than competitors. That's baked right into the scheme here, which is why I say, Your Honor, Judge Prado, that the test doesn't matter under any conceivable test. The covered securities aspects of the fraud are intrinsic to, and Judge Davis, this goes to your point, I think, they're intrinsic to the fraud here. This is just not a case where you have a scheme and sort of by complete coincidence, having nothing to do with the nature of the scheme, somebody buys or sells securities somewhere. And that's why I say under any imaginable test, even the toughest inducement test, this case is a very easy one for the court to decide, as I say, in a very conservative fashion without even making new law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Price. See, why are we back to you? No, Mr. Cooney.
Thank you.
Sorry.
May it please the court, Gordon Cooney for defendant SEI Investments in the consolidated FAR and Roland action. I'm not going to rehash the arguments by predecessor counsel, but I do want to focus a bit on the allegations in the FAR and Roland action against SEI. And I think there are two separate bases for affirmance in this case. First, as Judge Godbee details very, very carefully, the allegations against SEI in the consolidated FAR and Roland action include the same kinds of key allegations about how SIB was going to invest in covered securities as a predicate, the very crux of the scheme, and also concerning the plaintiff's sale of their IRA securities in order to buy the SIB CDs. But secondly, one of the things that's also present in the FAR and Roland case, the only claim against SEI in that action is under the Louisiana securities law. And the Louisiana securities law excludes debt instruments from the coverage of securities. The only basis the plaintiffs had to assert a claim under the Louisiana securities law was to convert that CD into something else, i.e. a security. And the plaintiffs relied on the same kinds of allegations that go to the crux of the scheme to form the only substantive count against SEI. So let me just take a minute to focus on the allegations against SEI and FAR and Roland. First of all, Mr. Price made some statements about how SEI was there at the outset with Stanford. That is not true. SEI was a vendor to Stanford. It provided computer software services to Stanford. Those factual issues are for another day. What the court can do is focus on the complaint, however. So if you look at the Roland complaint, and the Roland complaint and the Farr complaint, which are consolidated, track one another. But my citations will be to the Roland complaint. Paragraph 12 of the Roland complaint summarizes the misrepresentations and includes, for example, the promise of double-digit returns because of Stanford's investment strategy. And I would direct the court's attention in particular to paragraph 12K. Paragraph 20 of the Roland complaint touted the liquidity and minimal risk of its investment portfolio and talks about how representations were made that the proceeds would be, quote, invested in a well-diversified portfolio of highly marketable securities issued by stable governments, strong multinational companies, and major international banks. That's paragraph 20. It's repeated. Those kinds of allegations are repeated throughout the Farr and Roland petitions. It's characterized as the first misrepresentation in paragraph 36. And so it appears throughout the petition. Now, all of those allegations, members of the court, are incorporated in the sole count against SEI, which is count number 13, and the incorporation by reference appears in paragraph 199. And paragraph 200 in count 13, only against SEI, seeks to hold SEI liable for the misrepresentation of the investment advisor defendants. So Mr. Price was trying to suggest to the court that he was not seeking to hold SEI liable for this misrepresentations. That's completely inconsistent with count 13, which incorporates them by reference, and which specifically in paragraph 200 makes reference to attempting to hold SEI secondarily liable under section 714B of the Louisiana Securities Law for the misrepresentations of the investment advisor defendants. And so as a result, Judge Godbee correctly concluded that, as predecessor counsel has noted, this representation about how the proceeds supposedly were going to be invested to provide the double-digit rate of return and some security and stability, that went to the very heart of this case. And it's not just true with respect to the first two actions you heard about. It is quite clear, as detailed by Judge Godbee, against SEI in the Farr and Roland complaint. I think the centrality of that representation about how the proceeds were to be invested in highly marketable securities, including securities issued by major multinational companies, goes to the very heart of this case. And as predecessor counsel have noted, it really makes this case quite simple under the Davitt coincides with standard.
Do we look at it? You've been talking about what they have in their complaint. Do we look at it from the buyer's perspective, or do we look at it from the seller's perspective as to what was the seller representing, not what they thought they were seeing, but what in fact was the intent and what was represented by the seller?
Your Honor, I think you look at it from the standpoint of what's alleged, and I think the reasonable inference of what is alleged here is both this was stressed, and also given the prominence that it was given in the complaint, that this was important to the plaintiffs. And I think a fair reading of the complaint in terms of how this representation and iterations of it are repeatedly referenced throughout the body of the complaints in this case, show that this was central, and a fair inference is this not only was stressed as part of the scheme, but it was important to the plaintiffs. And this comes from the plaintiffs themselves. The plaintiffs put this in their complaints. The defendants aren't going outside the complaints and saying, hey, let's look at facts that are outside the complaint. I think if the court focuses on what's pled in these complaints in this case, it's clear that it's at the very heart of the scheme that's been pled.
So what is the test that we use here to determine connectivity then?
I think in this case, Judge Prado, the test can simply be stated that if it's a significant part of the complaint pled by plaintiffs, that SLUSA applies. I think there may be difficult questions for another day if the complaint isn't as plain as it is in these three cases. But I don't think this Court has that difficult job today. The second aspect in the case against SEI is that these allegations were not just important to the overarching scheme that's been alleged, but it also was critical to the only substantive count against SEI. As I said, count 13 of FAR and Roland is pled under the Louisiana securities law. That's the only count against SEI. The Louisiana securities law excludes CDs from the definition of securities, and that's section 51:702.15b2. So the plaintiffs had to allege that there was something different about these CDs that qualified them as securities. You heard a lot from counsel about these are just debt instruments. These are just debt instruments. Well, at least in the case against SEI, that would not be sufficient to state a claim. The plaintiffs only have a claim against SEI if the CDs qualified as securities. Now, what's the test for a security under Louisiana law? Under Louisiana law, the court in the Godair case, G-O-D-A-I-R, adopted the test by the Supreme Court in the Revis case. And what Godair says is the court has to examine the transaction to assess the motivations that would prompt a reasonable seller and buyer to enter into it. And in Revis, the Supreme Court decision, the court said that an important factor in that case is whether a primary inducement was an interest rate constantly revised to keep it slightly above the rate paid by local banks and S&Ls. So this is where this same allegation comes into play. The plaintiff's complaint alleges that they were motivated, that an important part of the scheme was the investment in covered securities that allowed them to get this double-digit rate of return. And that goes right to the Revis and Godair test. So as a result, members of the court, in the Farr and Roland case, this key allegation that appears repeatedly throughout the complaint is central not only to the scheme that's been alleged, but it's also critical to the only count against SEI under the Louisiana securities law.
Now, how do we factor in the policy legislative argument that's been made in interpreting the statute?
I guess I would say two things, Judge Prado. First of all, the Supreme Court considered that in the Davitt case and determined that SLUSA was to be given a broad interpretation with regard to in connection with. I think you also should note that one of the things the court talked about in the legislative history was a purpose of SLUSA and the PSLRA was to protect third-party, quote, deep-pocket defendants from being dragged into suits that they didn't belong in. And I don't think there's any quarrel with the idea that the investors here were badly hurt. I know from my client's perspective, SEI, it was a vendor. And so I think this goes to the very heart of SLUSA. One of the purposes of SLUSA in the PSLRA was to make sure that claims against third parties are going to be subject to the stringent standards of SLUSA and the PSLRA. And that's very much the case with regard to the claims against SEI, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Coon. Okay, Mr. Price. Thank
you. Judge, SEI never alleged this theory for 2 years. It's so plain. Why didn't they allege it? That's the biggest thing in this case that tells you that it only came up after the Madoff people put it as a theory. You go back and look at the record, SEI never alleged this plain theory anywhere in any of the remand or any of the removal.
They argued that your complaint made it clear that there was a connection here. How do you respond to that?
There is the incorporation provision. We have gone through in detail lining out the role that they played. And as we allege, they were to report on the SIB CDs, which, in my opinion, connotes what the value of those CDs are. All they had to do was ask Alan Stanford, what is the value of these CDs? And for 10 years, these people relied upon those statements that were being sent out monthly that they were worth 100% of the value. But I'll tell you what the most telling thing is, and we tend to get a far. First of all, Dabbitt and Zanford are not a case that involves the issuance of an uncovered security. Those are broker cases is what we call them. It's not a situation where you have an issuance, a 33 Act issuance of a covered security. Those are all broker fraud cases. The second thing, and this is probably the most important thing, look at the statute, whether SLUSA is applicable to a non-registered investment company. It's not. By definition, a registered or non-registered investment company invests in covered securities. But the 33 Act SLUSA and the 34 Act SLUSA says that a non-registered investment company is not subject to SLUSA. Now, what is that telling you? It's telling you don't look past the original transaction.
Well, counsel says if we just look at the original transaction here, you don't state a claim under the Louisiana Securities Act.
Well, the issue, the question of whether or not the security exists is certainly a question that we've got to move forward with in the Louisiana question. We disagree with that whole analysis. I mean, there's a whole body of law out there that defines what a security is and what a security isn't, but that's clearly an issue for another day and time. The law in this country is replete with this includes numerous issues where debentures and debt instruments are securities, particularly when they offer to unsophisticated people like my clients. But I would go back to the point, Judge Davis, and I can't overemphasize this. Everybody on this other side of the table has come up here and said, you look at the assets owned by the issuer. I am telling you that the law says you don't do that because a non-registered investment company is not subject to SLUSA. That is the literal language of the statute. And the law is real clear that when you're dealing with an issue of state law preclusion, the statute is narrowly interpreted. They don't have a response to that, I can tell you. You do not look at the assets of an issuer. So this whole smokescreen that's been created to expand Dabbitt to everything, the statute says no, that's not what you do. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Young.
May it please the court. What is the heart of a Ponzi scheme? What makes a Ponzi scheme is the payback of original investors, not with proceeds, but with later acquired principal. That is the heart of the Ponzi scheme in any Ponzi scheme, and that is the heart of the Ponzi scheme here. The fraud alleged in this case included, by my count, at least 8 different types of fraud. Fraud about insurance, fraud about audits, fraud about U.S. regulations, fraud about management experience and expertise, fraud about risk management review. The investment in securities was only one element of that fraud. The Zanford case says the fraud must coincide with the purchase or sale of securities. Well, we struggled today with what does coincide mean. I submit it means depend upon, and here the fraud was complete the minute the investor's money was obtained, regardless of whether Stanford purchased covered securities or did not purchase covered securities. Now, on the point that I started with, that there is no purchase or sale or contract to purchase or sell here, I would commend to the court the Falkowski case from the Ninth Circuit. And that is the case that explains why it is that a non-purchase can sometimes be a purchase and a non-sale can sometimes be a sale. It is not true categorically that any time someone says they're going to invest and they don't invest, that that is a purchase or sale. It becomes one because of the language of Section 10B and Rule 10B-5. Finally, I want to address the district court's speculation that there were covered securities at issue in this case. There are various formulations of the misrepresentation that were made, but perhaps the strongest one is that they were highly marketable securities issued by stable governments. Let's pause there. Government securities are not covered securities. Covered securities are those traded on the NYSE, the Amex, the NASDAQ, or any exchange that the SEC has declared to be equivalent. Government bonds don't qualify. Strong multinational companies, well, again, debt instruments would not be covered securities. And a strong multinational company might or might not be traded on one of those U.S. stock exchanges. And remember, we're talking about investments by an Antiguan bank, not investments by a bank here in the United States. And major international banks. Well, bank securities are typically debt securities, and there again, those are not covered securities. So what we're left with is a vague representation about a package of securities that SIB invested in, only some components of which might or might not include covered securities. And this is the problem with applying SLUSA to a non-purchase and a non-sale where there is not a contract for the purchase or sale. If there's a purchase, a sale, or a contract, we know what the covered securities are. We know that Bernie Madoff promised to invest his investors' funds in options on the S&P 100. Well, we know that the options on the S&P 100 are covered securities. Here we have to speculate whether and to what extent there were covered securities even involved in this case. That concludes my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We have your case. That completes the docket for the morning, and we'll be in recess until 9 o'clock.